Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. What is your definition of fast food? Many busy Americans have all but given up on the idea of cooking at home. But one of the world's best-known chefs is adamant that fast food does not have to come from a drive-through window.
You know, when I'm pressed by time, I love to do that very simple first course, which is airing in wine that you can buy at your supermarket. I put that with a little bit of sour cream, some diced apple and diced cucumber, a little bit of Tabasco. I always put a good dash of bottled horseradish, a few capers, you can put lemon juice as well. You mix that thoroughly. You have a beautiful first course if you place that right in the middle of a nice line, a glass lineup with beautiful salad like this. And this is a wonderful first course in seconds.
That was writer, teacher, and chef Jacques Pepin in his new PBS show, More Fast Food My Way. And he's here now to talk about it. Jacques, welcome to Think.
Well, I don't know if it's fast food or if food fast my way. You know,
so. Yeah, that's true, but I guess that the term fast food is so people can relate to that. What's your definition of fast? Is it half an hour and dinner's ready?
Well, I don't really know whether it has anything to do with time. It has to do with time, but often I do dishes which are longer to do, but extremely simple without taking much of your time. And that's saving of time, saving of effort, having good, fresh, you know, food that's, you know, making people's life easier is what I want to do.
I know that efficiency can make a difference. Can you talk about some of the maybe the techniques or the habits that home cooks can get into to save time?
Yes, certainly. You know, if you're proficient with your hand and if you have a sharp knife and a good cutting board, it does help, you know. But you see, in a professional kitchen, for example, there is two areas of the kitchen. There is what we call la mise en place in French, which is prep cook. And then the one who actually cook when you sit down in the restaurant. But everything is ready, so someone is going to bone out the fish for me, chop the shallot, slice the mushroom, and I have everything ready. So I'm at the stove, someone order a fish, I grab one of those fillets, a bit of shallot, a bit of white wine, sliced mushroom, boil it 1 minute and a half, take it out, finish it up in like 3, 4, 5 minutes. Why? Because things are ready for me. So what I do here, I use the market and the prep cook. You know, basically. And now markets are much better than they used to be. So I can get skinless, boneless breast of chicken and pre-sliced mushroom and pre-washed spinach. And I go there, I have a non-stick pan, I put it on the stove within 5 minutes. 7, 8 minutes, I have breast of chicken. That's cooking from scratch, you know. So it is different than when I was a kid. We had to run after the chicken. If we didn't have to kill it, I had to pluck it, eviscerate it. And, you know, cook it on something where everything sticks, you know. So it was a big operation to do a chicken. Now it's pretty simple.
And I understand that when you were a kid, you wore out a lot of shoe leather going back and forth to the market for your mother's restaurant.
That's true. When I was a kid, you know, my market would do the marketing was the most important. You know, before we went to school, you know, my brother and I, it sounds very romantic now, but I don't think we liked it too much. Walking along the river in Lyon, you know, there is a big market starting around 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, open market. So we did the market carrying the stuff back with my mother. We'd try to get the best price that she could from the vendor, you know.
Do you like that part of the process now? Do you like shopping for food?
Oh, yeah, I love shopping. Mm-hmm. I love to go to the market. That's where I get ideas, you know. So I go, I say, I think I'm going to do a leg of lamb today with some artichokes. And I come back with a duck and zucchini because maybe it's on sale or it's there, it looks nice. So that's where I do my menu, usually at the market.
Now, I know that you, again, are not opposed to buying pre-washed lettuce and you want your chicken and your everything filleted ahead of time. Are there shortcuts that you could take that you don't, things that are available for convenience sake that you think sort of diminish the quality of the meal?
Well, certainly I avoid any processed food, you know, in general, because I think they're pretty bad for you. So you can still have fresh ingredients. But if I look at a can of, cannellini beans, and I see that it's made with water and beans and salt. That's basically what I use when I do it. So I may as well use it, you know, to make my life easier. Or if I use a can of, you know, apricot, for example, in can, or pear, well, it's the fruit syrup, I mean, the fruit, sugar, and water. That's basically what I do if I poached it. So I have no problem using those ingredients.
So you've done something like 24 cookbooks, I know.
Something like that, yes.
But you don't necessarily expect people to follow the recipe to the letter every time they use your books.
No, absolutely not. When you do a recipe, you know, you do it, you should follow it to the letter, at least the first time. And if it comes out good, you're likely to do it again. The second time, you take a faster look, see how long does he leave it in the oven, whatever. And the third time, you may not even take a look at it. By the fourth time, you, quote, improve the recipe. You say, I think I'll put a little more tomato in there. Right? And by a year later, you don't even know where you get that recipe. That becomes your recipe, you know.
So it's
That's
still
a normal
evolving.
Progression, mm-hmm. yes.
Does that happen when you're cooking for your show? Do you always have everything down? I know that the production folks like to know what's coming next. Are you
yes.
still switching around the recipes?
Yes, I think my producer, Tina Salter, they told me that I am the man with the most extraordinary memory that she ever met. Because sometimes we do the show, like four recipes, and I try to do it in one shot without cutting in between.
Wow.
So, you know, the four cameras, so I say I'll start. They call that B1, burner one, put something on the burner one, then I turn around, I'll grab this, and I'll do this, and I'll do that. And I go through the whole show like this, and the thing that I have a great memory, when in fact I have no memory whatsoever. It's purely professionally for me in my head, I say I'm going to start that fish on this side. It has to cook for like a minute and a half. During that time, I'll put that in the oven, come back, grab the salad, turn the fish over, continue. So I follow the menu in my head much more than memory. It has nothing to do with it.
And I guess it's just a matter of practice and knowing what you're doing. I think I'll speak for myself here, not for all cooks, but timing things is really difficult when you're sort of first learning to put together a meal.
It's true. The timing is maybe one of the most difficult so that everything comes out together, mm-hmm. you know. People, you have a menu with, let's say, a rack of lamb, I mean, that's your main course, and you have a tart or something, and people will tend to say, let's start with the rack of lamb, because that's the main course. Well, when you should start with the soup. Best example, when you cook pasta, people prepare everything that they have, and they say, okay, let's put some water on to boil. Well, you start with putting the water on to boil, because by the time everything else is ready, your water is barely boiling, then you can drop your pasta in it, you know. I can get home and I do a soup, and because those type of recipes, it's not that all of a sudden I cook this way. I always cook this way to a certain extent. That is, I may spend a lot of time over the weekend and do slow food. You know, that's why we do slow food. We do food in the microwave oven, very fast, very slow. And then we have a regular stove, which is used very seldom, somewhere in between, you know. But in any case, here, I would go to shopping somewhere, and I come home, and it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I say, I'm hungry, so I do one of those recipes. At that point, my mother cooked this way, my French chef, everyone that I know cooked this way at some point, not all. So for me, it was a question of extrapolating those recipes and making a book out of it when you cook this way.
Do you ever eat leftovers?
There's never any leftover. The leftover that we are transformed into another meal. Mm-hmm. Ex nihilo, it's just something new. We never use the word leftover.
Now, I know that your wife cooks sometimes when you're home together. Do you clean when it's her night to cook?
I clean when I cook. She has to clean when she cooks. Uh-huh. No. We've been married 43 years or so. So it's not like when she cooks and I come into the kitchen that she will say, oh, darling, what do you think? Usually her first word is, don't touch anything. <That's usually. laughs>
When you're cooking at work, what's the balance for you between creativity in the kitchen and discipline and organization?
Well, that's a good question, you know. To be a chef professionally, you have to be a very good technician. You have to be a craftsman, and that's what I do. And in order to, I am probably known with books like technique more for my technique and so forth, you know, which is purely a question of repeat those rules so that it becomes so much part of yourself that now you can afford to forget them. You can afford to think in terms of texture, in terms of color, and automatically your hands are working. I mean, look at a beginner, you know, slicing an onion, and you come around, you say, do you have any parsley? He said, don't disturb me. So, I mean, you're totally kind of obnubilated, if you want, by that task. And you don't have anything to think forward to. So you have to get rid of that. And by getting rid of that is to repeat, repeat, repeat. So that being said, you become a good craftsman. You can move very fast, which is good, but you may be a lousy cook. You know, I know chefs which are pretty good craftsmen, pretty good technician, or very good even, and are relatively lousy food. I mean, the food is okay because they don't have much talent. But you know, conversely, I know people who are very talented, great sense of taste, but are really lousy techniques, so the food is all over the place. Half of it is wasted. There is enough leftover for, you know, those things have to work together. A good chef should be a good technician and have some talent, you know.
How much of great cooking is really about taste and developing your sensitivity to flavor?
It's all about taste. It's all, I mean... I always say in a jest that any food critic should be blind, should be requested by law, so that they can go to the heart of the matter and tell you whether it's good or not. Because often too much is placed on the aesthetic of food, especially with young chefs, you know,
which
are obsessed with the plate or the aesthetic value of that plate. And it comes to a point when, you know, you have to torture the food to that extent to make it palatable for people so that they consent to taste your food, you know, when to excite their palate, you know, when basically half of the world is dying of hunger. You come to a point, you say, what are we doing, you know? So taste is what's important. Look at in Chinese cooking or many other cooking, the food is done, plop on the plate, and there is a certain spontaneity, a certain color, a certain look, something very natural like that. That being said, you know, you can still present a plate nicely, but not at the expense of the taste ever.
As busy as you are always committed to teaching. And I'm wondering what you get out of working with students.
Oh, a lot of gratification. It's great. You know, I work with students. I teach at Boston University for the last 24 years and at the French Culinary Institute in New York. I was there last week, and I was at BU actually the week before. So I work with those students who are 30 years old or less or a little more, and I feel like them, you know, unless I look at myself in a mirror and I scare myself. But yes, keep you young and gratified, and I like to teach. I always did.
How often do chefs really want to know what you think about their work, and how often do they really just want a compliment from you?
Well, that's a good question. You know, sometimes it depends on the type of chef. You'll go somewhere and people will take you around and they are kind of half apologetic. They say, well, you know, here we cannot get that type of product and they cannot afford it, so I do that. So it seemed to me that the chef is saying, you know, I know it could be better than that, but, you know, that's what I can do here. Then you go to another place, you know, the Sheraton, and the chef will give you his stuff, whatever he cooks, and it's pretty bad. And he's, you know, to use an existentialist expression, is in good faith. I mean, for him, this is great. His mother tell him it's great. I mean, his wife tell him it's great. So, and it's pretty bad. So at that point, you know, there is no hope. So he tell you, how is it? And you can tell him, you know, yeah, we know what. You'll never be better than today. And he's very happy with himself.
That's a good way out of that.
It's a good way out of it. I stole that somewhere. I don't know who said that first, but not me.
Well, it's yours now.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you always refer to yourself as a craftsman. I know that when you have spare time, you paint, you create furniture. You don't think of yourself as an artist?
Not really. Not in the cooking. I have a book called Chez Jacques, which is kind of visual autobiography. I have a lot of my painting in it, and I did an essay actually in there on painting and cooking. And I don't equate the great, certainly the painter, with even the greatest cook. I think that there is some talent and there is some artistry in what we do, but mostly we are craftsmen and. I think that's what we do. I don't equate that with Picasso or great painter. No, not at all.
It's also interesting to me that you keep painting even though you don't think of yourself as a great painter necessarily.
Well, then the reason is technique. We come back to this. I didn't spend years and years of my life to mix paint and to know exactly the tone of color and to get the perfect effect I could get with my thumb or a brush or a spatula, you know. So I'm not a good technician in painting. So I start a painting. I don't know where I'm going. Make a mess out of it, throw it out, paint over. Sometimes it comes out pretty good, I mean, for me. And then I go on, but there is a certain, you know, contingency here that I cannot really control. As opposed to the food, at the risk of sounding presumptuous, after almost 60 years in the kitchen now, I can taste the recipe in my head, and when I do it, and even if the hammer doesn't hit the nail right on the top, it's pretty close. I do a couple of corrections, I'm there, because I can, because technically I know that I can do that, you know, and I have the idea, the recipe in my hand, kind of exercise it. I don't have that in painting. I don't have that type of control. And, you know, in painting it's the same way too. I know people who work in studio for a few years and know all the law of perspective and know that you can mix yellow and blue to make green, and you do that with your thumb too. After 3 years in the studio, you can stand anywhere and do a painting. Does that make you an artist? No, you're a pretty good craftsman. But if you happen to have talent, and if you have the technique in your hand, then you can take that talent somewhere and do something with it. And in cooking, too, if you're a good technician and you happen to have talent, someone like, you know, Thomas Keller or, you know, then they can do something because they are technically good and then they have talent.
Jacques, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
The new show is called More Fast Food My Way. It airs Saturday afternoons at 4:30 on KERA 13. Just ahead, what state fair tradition raises hundreds of thousands of dollars for education? If you only go to the Midway in the Car show, you've missed it. We'll explain after the Arts Calendar.
The Art and Sea Calendar for this weekend includes The Undead, A Haunted Holiday, and an otherworldly comedy. Find out what happens when a novelist unleashes the frisky spirit of his dead wife in a seance as Stage West in Fort Worth presents Blythe Spirit. Teatro Dallas goes back in time to 16th century Seville for Don Juan the Vampire, an exploration of love, lust, and bloodthirsty intrigue, based on Zorilla's Don Juan Tenorio and directed by Cora Cardona. Opening at the Bathhouse Cultural Center, it's time for the 22nd annual Dia de los Muertos exhibit, featuring works from local, state, national, and international artists honoring those who've made the transition. And in conjunction with the Bathhouse's Day of the Dead exhibit, keep the music alive with Twang and Friends, with musically inspired paintings and mixed media works celebrating rock and roll and honky-tonk luminaries, from Dallas artist Jose Vargas. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Do your kids know where their food comes from? The ones vying for youth livestock prizes at the State Fair of Texas definitely do, because they are directly involved with raising what ends up on our tables. They compete not just for bragging rights, but for a shot at hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarships. Daryl Riel joins us to explain how it all works. He is Vice President of Agriculture and Livestock for the State Fair of Texas. Daryl, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I read last week that the Grand Champion steer was sold for $95,000, raised by a 12-year-old girl.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am. It's a lot of money for a young lady.
How much, what kind of work goes into raising that animal?
A lot is the answer. Most of the kids that have these animals, at the steers at the fair, they've put about 6 months or better into them. Some of them even longer. Many of the steers, the kids raise them from birth. And so a lot of those steers can be 18 months old by the time they get to the fair. So they've got a year and a half invested before they get to sell them last Friday.
They've got time invested. And in certain animals, you develop sort of an emotional relationship. But these are not pets.
Well, they are and they aren't. You can't spend 18 months with a living creature without having some bond and some relationship there, or even 6 months. But at the end of the day, this is a educational process, and all of these animals are entering the food chain. So it's a food industry, and it's a youth development vehicle that we use to teach them about the food industry and production agriculture.
Are you ever able to witness sort of a bittersweet moment where someone has worked with this animal and has won a prize and then kind of realizes what comes next?
I have experienced that moment myself when I was a kid. But yes, every year there are some tears shed because, again, there is that bond that's made there. But again, at the end of the day, it's all about learning about this project, and the project is a agriculture food industry product.
So, and I guess the animals are judged either according to sort of market, meaning how much meat they would produce and how good it would be, and then some of them are also judged according to breed.
Yes, ma'am. We actually have different breed divisions, just like in people. You have people that are better at other things depending on their heritage and their background and their genealogy. In animals, the same way. So different breeds are developed to be good at different characteristics. In a market animal show, though, at the end of the day, what we're looking to produce in cattle, say, or steers is beef. And so we're looking for the best beef product. So the kids are out there, that, or rather the judge, is judging these kids' projects for which one's going to make the best steak, essentially.
I walked through the barns just a couple of days ago, and there was a little girl blow-drying her cow.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a lot that goes into making them look just perfect on that day.
Most definitely. They spend hours and hours, especially right ahead of time, but then they spend hours a day with these animals. You know, animals in commercial production don't get this kind of attention because there's not a $95,000 prize on the line in the commercial feedlot. But for the fair and other livestock shows, competitions like this, there's typically a pretty good apple at the end of it. So while we're trying to create the best steak, we also work hard to make it's a show, and so we like to make them look good too.
So you'll have to explain something to me. I think a lot of parents in the city or in the suburbs, you know, have a hard time getting their kids to take out the trash or to feed the family dog. Is there something different about kids who are in FHA and FFA? Are they, or 4-H, are they somehow, are they wired differently?
Maybe. I tell you, the largest pool of the kids that participate have parents that participated before. Or they've got an advisor that in whether it's their FFA advisor or their county extension 4-H agent that has prodded them on and encouraged them to be a part of this project, because it definitely takes a lot of time and effort. Many of the animals are fed twice a day. They're fed before breakfast, before school in the mornings, and then the afternoons are going back and they're feeding again, but then the afternoon is when they really spend the time, especially on the steer project in particular. For the fair, they don't have to have a really nice coat of hair, but for other shows, they do, and they really work hard at those animals to get them prepared.
And how sensitive are these kids in terms of, do they ever get to taste the product and sort of see and so that they can tell what their work did?
Not in this particular competition, but there are other competitions that allow them to do that. There's meats judging competitions where you actually judge the steaks themselves that you can get involved in through 4-H FFA. But with this particular, with the Grand Champion steer, that was not the case.
What do you see when city kids come in and tour the barns? What's their response to everything?
Probably in awe. Many times, we have some other great educational programs that we focus with elementary kids in particular to let them know that milk doesn't just come from a carton, and that's a cliche that gets used all the time, but it's something that's so important a lot of people don't realize. So when they come through the barns, a lot of times they'll ask questions of, wow, where does bacon come from? Where does a ribeye come from? You know, where's the T-bone at on this animal? So there's a lot, it's in awe, and they want to learn. And so we put some people out in the barns to work as liaisons and educators to answer those questions.
Do you have a sort of sentimental favorite competition?
Oh, I guess growing up on a hog farm, maybe that biases me to that way. But all the kids work just as hard to get to try and win the grand champion of their division. And we work hard at the youth auction to try and give them some money to reward them with.
Daryl, thank you so much for coming in.
Yes, ma'am. I enjoyed it. Thank you, ma'am.
The State Fair of Texas continues through Sunday, October 19th. You can go to the Think page of KERA's website to download free video and audio podcasts of the show. And our email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week. It's great.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. by Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.